Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. About 5 million Americans have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And if you're over 50, forgetting a name or losing a key is more than an inconvenience. It raises the specter of dementia. Early detection can help. But testing for this sort of decline is time-consuming and complicated. Some OSU researchers, however, have developed an assessment that requires nothing more than a pencil, a piece of paper, and about 15 minutes. Here to tell us more about it is Dr. Doug Shari. He's director of the Division of Cognitive Neurology and head of the Memory Disorders Research Center at Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. Dr. Shari developed the test with his research team at OSU. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I took the test this morning.
How'd you do?
Quickly. I think I did okay, but I think I'd probably leave that to the experts to judge, because ultimately you still, if you take the test, someone who knows what they're doing needs to review it.
It's best to have your physician take the test to your physician so that they can interpret it based on your health history and decide if there's any further evaluation that needs to be done.
Is this something that physicians would be familiar with if I did just bring it in to my nurse practitioner or my, you know, my internist or my regular doctor?
Well, the test has been out there for 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
And so some physicians are very familiar with it and others have never heard of it before. But there's instructions about how to grade it and interpretation, and our findings from the studies are on the website for physicians. And so they can easily learn about the test if someone brings it into their office and they've never seen it before.
Dr. Shari, you're talking about using this test to set a baseline, really, for a person's cognitive functionings. Should we note that this is not a tool to diagnose Alzheimer's, right?
That's correct. It's not a diagnostic test. It's a screening test. So to say, am I thinking well? How's my brain or mind doing? And it just opens the conversation to the physician to try to figure out, you know, what might be going on, because there's multiple reasons why someone might have cognitive issues, and one could be early dementia or Alzheimer's, but there's many, many more possibilities that could be going on that could be treatable.
I thought we could talk about actually what the test looks like and what some of the questions are, just to give people an idea of what we are talking about. It starts out, the title of it is How Well Are You Thinking? And it has the usual questions, your name and how far you got in school and that sort of a thing. And asks some medical questions. Have you ever had a major stroke, a minor stroke? Do you currently feel sad or depressed? That sort of thing. It asks you to make some calls about yourself. Do you have more difficulties doing everyday activities due to thinking problems? That, I would think, might be hard for some people to answer.
So this is a self-assessment, and it's helpful if they think they have memory problems or not. That's one of the first questions as well. How much insight do they have? That's what we're trying to get at that question, and may help the doctors know if they don't do perfectly well on the test, is it because they've had a history of all these strokes or a family history, or they're depressed? And that might lead the doctor to ask more questions in those directions immediately that might correlate with their test scores.
What about the question about ethnicity? Why is that important here?
Well, we have gender, education, mm-hmm. ethnicity are all very important in terms of scoring the test. And so we're very interested in knowing particularly education, because lower educated people always will do worse on cognitive tests. And in fact, we have age and education normative values. So if you're really low education, we'll add a point, you know, to your score to try to even it up. And that's true for any cognitive test. And we also want to make sure that we study all different minorities to see if this test is biased in some way for some minorities, maybe not just education effect, and maybe there is a reading or a minority effect. And so we're gathering information in terms of making the test appropriate for all people.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest, Dr. Doug Shari. He's director of the Division of Cognitive Neurology and head of the Memory Disorders Research Center at Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. We're talking about a test. It's to establish a baseline for memory and how you're thinking, how well you're thinking, what your cognitive abilities are. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Shari, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The first question, regular question of it is, what is today's date? And then there in parentheses, it says, from memory, no cheating. Because, I mean, I immediately looked on my computer because I'm terrible on dates now. We don't have calendars up on the walls anymore or anything like that, usually.
Well, in general, it's good to use memory aids, and yeah. We take lists when we go to this grocery store, and we use watches and calendars, and I'm not suggesting people don't do that, but this test is designed to test, do you know about what the date is? And if you're pretty close, you get points for that. If you're way off, then you won't get points. So it helps us see how much you're in the current situation, and that matters with cognition.
There is another one. It says, name the following pictures. Do those pictures change from time to time? If not, could you tell me why you picked those particular items?
Well, there's four separate forms of the test, and they're all different, and each of the four forms have different pictures. And we graded the pictures, some a little easier, some a little harder, to even it out. We wanted to pick pictures that aren't maybe the most obvious things, because we're trying to test, how much you may not know or can't remember or can't come up with a name or a word. So the pictures are all devised and were picked out because of their degree of difficulty. So those aren't changed routinely, because that would change the scoring of the test. Any little thing might change the scoring of the test, so we keep everything pretty much the same.
Should you take all four forms?
You just take one test.
Okay.
The reason we have four is if you're going to take it again next year or follow up, you won't maybe remember what you had before. You reduce the learning effect. And for research, we use that a lot. It's always nice to have different forms to reduce learning effect I remember this question from last time. Mm-hmm. And so that might give you a better score than, maybe you should have had.
If physicians don't have a starting point, a baseline like this on hand for a patient, how much harder is it to diagnose? How is it diagnosed?
Well, a memory loss and cognitive issues can be hard, because you take a history, and some people complain more than others of their cognitive issues. And that's why it's good to have an objective test. Some people may have had, maybe they've had a few strokes, some head trauma, and they have lost a few brain cells, and that's them, and they're not going to have early Alzheimer's disease. And their baseline might be lower, or their talents are different than someone else. And so they may not be an artist, and they're not good at drawing, but they're great at vocabulary. And so everyone has different talent levels. And so it's always best to get a baseline. So then you know what they are when they're thinking normally, if they're not having problems. And maybe you'd get it at a Medicare age. They have the annual wellness visit. Our suggestion is to do it maybe on a yearly basis, to do a cognitive screen.
Starting?
At 62, okay. Or something. That's the Medicare age. That would be paid for,
okay,
by Medicare, free of charge. And maybe yearly thereafter. And then when you're 72 and you're beginning to have cognitive issues, then you can catch it on year one instead of waiting to 3 or 4 years, as really is the case right now, that patients just do not come in early for these issues. They think everyone has memory problems as they get older. Everyone forgets, and it happens occasionally. And the doctor's so busy, I'm not going to bother a busy doctor with something that's just so insidious and everyone has it. And so they don't bring it up. And even if the doctor asks, how's your memory, they usually hide it because they may be embarrassed. They don't want to admit that they have memory problems. Oh, it's all right.
I haven't reached that point yet. I'm very willing to admit it. If you're not willing to admit it, is it sort of like a drinking problem? Maybe there is a problem?
Most likely. So if you have less insight, that's an early sign of Alzheimer's at times. So there's other things that can do that. The people that almost sort of deny it more likely are the ones that you really should be testing. Although, on the other hand, if you're thinking well, this test is also very useful to, give you confidence and verify in yourself, yes, I did well. I've had multiple emails. People take the test. They say, thank you. I was worried about myself. I guess I did almost perfect on this test. I feel much better.
Your team developed the SAGE. It's called SAGE test. The S-A-G-E stands for?
Self-administered Geral Cognitive Examination.
They developed the test itself a few years ago, but you just did a study on how effective it is for large numbers of seniors to take on their own. What were you interested in finding out there, and what did you find out?
So the first we studied the test, we said, does it measure what we want it to measure? How valid is it? And we found that, yes, if you scored bad on it, you did poor on more significant cognitive tests. And if you scored well on it, you did very well on those tests. So that was the first study. In this study, we wanted to say, we need to get this out to more people. So we took it to the community, screening, health screening events, talks at senior centers, or memory screens. And we could have people, maybe 50 people might show up for a talk at the senior center. And we'd pass out the test, and in 10, 15 minutes, we have 50 people that were screened. Whereas previously, non-self-administered tests, which is the norm, you come in for a screening, you have someone say, okay, what's this called? Remember these words, write this down. And after 10, 15 minutes, you have one person screened. And it wasn't as effective. We're able to score it rapidly, tell them, here, take the test to your physician. You did great. They can keep it as a baseline to compare for the future, or there's a little bit of problems. They should maybe could look at further evaluation to see what's the cause behind all that.
Obviously, some people will have to have the test delivered person to person for all different kinds of reasons, sight, maybe they have a reduced sight or something like that. Be that as it may, did you notice any differences, or have you looked at the differences in how people achieve on this test when it's given on a one-to-one, or when it's given orally versus when it's a written test like this?
So the SAGE is specifically designed to take it on your own, and you have as much time to take it. And so people that have poor sight cannot take it. At times we have just given them oral tests, but that's the same as any other. There's hundreds of different cognitive tests that you can evaluate someone. And so there's lots of good choices and lots of good tests out there, and we can use any of those tests in those individuals. And the real claim, feature and important feature of this test is that it's self-administered, that they can do it virtually anywhere and do it on their own, and also sort of feel less stressed. There's ability of some anxiousness if someone's asking you face-to-face, and you get nervous. If you're just by yourself and you can change the pages back and forth and check up on this, people take it, tolerate it very well. Almost no one says, oh, I quit or I'm walking out of the room. They'll sit and take it, and they finish it, and it gives us a good score.
There is a link that we're going to post on our website where you can see the tests and take it. I mean, where you can print it out and take it online, right?
Correct.
Yeah, and that'll be at our website at wosu.org/allsides. I was wondering, are you going to distribute this to nursing homes, community centers, that sort of thing? Are you going to make it available to people?
Well, it's available through the web.
Right, right.
And all over the world, people are using it. We have it in different languages and more to come. It's being translated and validated in different languages currently. So it's free of charge.
So any community center or nursing home could just print up a pile of these. And,
exactly.
Yeah. And what about people who might want to see if their parents, would you recommend people bring this home to their parents? And
absolutely. I think that either you can take it yourself and bring it in, or you may know of a parent that you're noticing things, the doctor hasn't mentioned anything, the parent's not really complaining about it, and you feel frustrated as a son or daughter because nothing's happening, and your parent, you just see them getting more and worse and worse with their memory and their thinking. And so it'd be perfect to have mom or dad take it. Then you can send it to the doctor, or you can have them bring it in the next time they go, so that the doctor then has some objective measure to say, wow, I didn't think your mom had that kind of issues. It's more than I would expect. Let's look into this.
And just for the record, Mom, I'm not thinking of you when I ask that question. Dr. Doug Shari, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Dr. Doug Shari, he's the director of the Division of Cognitive Neurology and head of the Memory Disorders Research Center at OSU's Wexner Medical Center. Once again, we'll have a link to the self-administered gerocognitive examination, the SAGE test on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has been in the news a lot lately, but before lane closings and Hurricane Sandy reconstruction funds, there was another topic at least the comedians couldn't resist.
And yesterday, Christie gave a 107-minute press conference to address the scandal. Man, the last time Chris Christie talked for 107 minutes, he was ordering at IHOP. And
Eek, that was late night's Jimmy Fallon taking a cheap shot at the governor for being overweight. But a preference for slim politicians is by no means a 21st century fad. A paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine highlighted the struggles President W.H. Taft of Ohio had bringing his weight to under 300 pounds. That's one of the many stories in this month's University of California School of Public Health Wellness Letter. And joining us now to tell us more is Dr. John Swartzberg, chair of the editorial board of the Wellness Letter. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
So President Taft was what you might call a celebrity dieter. Tell us about that.
Well, when he was 48, just a very few years before he became president, he was weighing around 315 pounds. And he didn't think that was going to be very good for his election in terms of just popularity. And so he really wanted to slim down. And he did. He went from 315 pounds to about 255 pounds. Quite a remarkable goal, about 60 pounds.
And he was a big guy. He wasn't.
He was. At that time, he was 48 years old and he was 6'2". He wasn't real tall, but he was certainly much taller than average. But still, 315 pounds, quite a bit.
And 255, not so great either in this day and age.
No, but quite an improvement.
Yeah, definitely. He was told by doctors to keep careful track of his diet in a journal. And it sounds a lot like the advice I hear on this show all the time from nutritionists and physicians.
You know, that's what I really found interesting. When his advice that he got from a weight loss specialist in England, who he actually never met but corresponded with regularly, was essentially the same advice we're giving today. A good diet plan, a lot of support around him, and making him accountable. Every week, Taft had to write to this doctor in England and tell him what he had been eating.
And is that when he did lose the weight?
That's when he lost the weight. That's right.
The diet also included the actual components of the diet, lean meat, fish.
Yeah, nothing really surprising.
Right.
It's the kind of stuff we advise today. It was interesting. It was lean meat and fish, as you say, but it also included specifically gluten biscuits, which I found amusing given all the talk today about sprue.
Why might that have been?
I'm not sure. It isn't clear from the article, and it wasn't clear from any of the research we did on this. But along with that was green vegetables, lots of vegetables with no butter, salads, clear soups, unsweetened fruits. Coffee and tea were fine, but couldn't use sugar, no snacks, no desserts. Actually, wine was okay, and he encouraged wine at lunch. That was probably the only difference that we see today from the diet that was given to Taft.
Mealtimes were regimented. Is that something that could be beneficial to us, you know, is that something that we might hear today?
That seems to be a pretty standard advice and helpful to most people, and that is to really know what you're going to eat, sit down and eat it, don't eat between meals. This kind of stuff we've been hearing for years, and it all makes sense. Unfortunately for Taft, one other thing made sense, and that was that these diets that people go on where they do lose weight, almost regularly, they can't keep it off. The recidivism rate is somewhere close to 90%. And Taft was in that group. He became president, and he cycled up and down. As a matter of fact, at the time of his inauguration, which was 3 years after he lost all that weight, he was up to 354 pounds.
And he had his own chef. You know, I always thought if I could just get my own chef.
Yeah, well, that helps. But you still have to eat only what the chef prepares for you and nothing more.
Ah, okay. So maybe he was a snacker or something.
Maybe. But, you know, the other thing that was interesting is that he lived to age 73, which was long at that time. Mm-hmm. And he was still obese. When he died, he was 280 pounds.
So what does that tell us?
I'm not sure. It tells us that weight is definitely a risk factor. It doesn't tell us that, but we know weight is a risk factor for diabetes, atherosclerosis, et cetera. But some people can deal with that weight and live a reasonably long life. On the other hand, how long would have Taft have lived had he been much slimmer?
Right. You also, in the newsletter, the wellness letter, wrote about the controversial breast cancer drug tamoxifen. Can we talk about that? It's a pill, right?
Sure. Right. And the drug isn't really controversial. What's controversial, or what has really been talked about a lot lately, is that there are probably a lot of women who should consider being on either tamoxifen or its cousin, raloxifen. These drugs have been around for quite a while.
You mean women who don't have breast cancer?
I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, women who are at high risk for breast cancer or who have had breast cancer and are at high risk for recurrence. In the latter group, we've known that women regularly get put on tamoxifen after they've had breast cancer. Mm-hmm. But women who are at very high risk for breast cancer should talk to their physicians about the role of these drugs to help prevent it. This goes back to the data that we've had for quite a while, that these drugs for women at high risk can substantially reduce the risk of developing breast cancer.
Why is it controversial then?
Well, I think there's one very good reason that women aren't taking it and that it is somewhat controversial in doctors' minds, and that is that there's no free lunch with this. These drugs have complications, tamoxifen more so than raloxifen. What they do is they block the estrogen receptors, the receptors on the cells in the breast, from the effect of estrogen, which seems to be the major mechanism by how they prevent recurrence or the development of breast cancer, but they act as proestrogen in other tissue. So, for example, they will increase the risk of uterine cancer. That's probably the biggest and most serious risk, but another big one is that they increase the risk of blood clots in the legs, and these can break off and go to the lungs, called pulmonary emboli. That can be life-threatening. They can increase the risk of strokes and cataracts. And a lot of women don't like the effects of them because the effects really include the symptoms of early menopause. You can get hot flashes, vaginal discharge or dryness, and that mental fogginess that's sometimes seen.
Mental fogginess.
Yeah.
So the other drug you mentioned, raloxifen?
Raloxifen. It hasn't been out quite as long, but both of these drugs have been out well over 20 years. Raloxifen doesn't appear quite as effective in preventing breast cancer as tamoxifen, but it also has fewer side effects, particularly the early menopausal side effects for those kinds of symptoms. I think what women should do is, if they are at high risk, they should talk to their physician about the pros and cons of these drugs. There are probably a lot of women who should seriously consider the drugs. One thing that you can do on your own is to go to the website cancer.gov and look at the cancer risk assessment tool. This is from the National Cancer Institute, and you can plug in your information about this: when you had your first menstrual period, how old you were, when your first child was born, or if you've never had children, do you have a first-degree relative with breast cancer, have you had a breast biopsy? Those tend to be the big questions. You plug all that in, and if your risk is greater than, people debate the number, but 1.7 to 2%, some people say 5% for developing breast cancer in the next 5 years, you may be a candidate for these drugs.
When it comes to, say, tamoxifen, does it prevent all kinds of breast cancer or just certain kinds? Because we know there's the bad kind, there's the not-so-bad kind.
Well, it prevents the most common kind of breast cancer. It also problems with what's called DCIS or LCIS. These are not cancer per se, but they can predispose people to developing cancer.
Moving on to another topic in the wellness letter is this month is grains. And yeah. Anti-carbohydrate diets are popular now. We just mentioned the oddity of the doctor requiring President Taft to eat gluten biscuits. But Americans continue to eat about 130 pounds of wheat a year per person. You talk about some great alternatives. Let's talk about amaranth. Is that
right?
How I pronounce?
Yeah, amaranth. Mm-hmm. There have been a lot of new grains have been introduced to the American market in the last few years, and some of these are really interesting. They're not these super grains that you often see promoted. That's hyperbole, but they are healthful and they also add variety to our diet. All of these should be whole wheat. Should be whole. That is, they should contain the bran, the germ, and the endosperm, like whole wheat does, mm-hmm. or brown rice as opposed to white rice. So they tend to be very, very healthy with lots of different things, vitamins, calcium, other minerals. Many of them, like amaranth, are gluten-free. Amaranth is an interesting one. It's been around for a long, long time. It was the major food crop of the Aztecs. It's really tiny. It's sort of like couscous. Some people may eat that. Mm-hmm. It's pretty high in calcium, about 50 milligrams for 3.5 ounces. That's got more calcium than most grains. It's almost always a whole grain, the way it's prepared, because the grains are so small. People really like that. So it's quite a healthful one. It contains a lot of amino acids, so it's felt to be a complete protein, much more so than the other grains.
It's compared to, as far as its balance of essential amino acids and so forth, it's compared to quinoa.
Right. Yeah, quinoa is another really popular one. It's on a national advertisement where people sort of make fun of it. But that's the grain that's called the mother of all grains. This one was used by the Incas. Mm-hmm. It was actually considered sacred. And it's still used throughout the Andes, and now it's become popular in the United States. It comes in over 100 different varieties, so there's lots of different varieties of quinoa.
Why can't we? The quinoa does have a little bit of controversy associated with it, and maybe some of these others do too, but that it's a staple in the Andes, and the price is going up there for this because of the demand in the United States.
Right. That's one of the great ironies. The importation of this of quinoa has really raised the price for people who were raising the price of this really valuable grain has been a problem in the Andes. Hopefully we'll start doing a lot more domestic production of this.
Is it something that you can produce domestically? Do you know anything about that, about why it's not?
It tends to grow much better in the very high altitudes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But there are places in the United States where people have been experimenting with this with some success. So hopefully we can start growing it here where the price will come down here and make it much more affordable for people in the Andes as well.
I wanted to, before we run out of time, make sure we got to your column about antibiotics.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I think is there a day when we will not be able to use antibiotics anymore?
Well, you know, this is what doctors talk about. We call the post-antibiotic future, and that is, it is a realistic fear that in our lifetimes, or not too long after that, antibiotics may be a thing of the past. We may look back and say, gee, that was a good 100 years we had with those antibiotics, but we no longer have them. And the problem, of course, are these, quote, superbugs that are arising for one major reason, and that is the abuse of antibiotics. Antibiotics are arguably the most powerful and wonderful tool that medicine has found and created. It's hard to imagine what life would be like without them, frankly.
Well, why would When you talk about abusive antibiotics, you're saying you're taking them when there is not a bacterial infection to fight. But what's the harm in taking antibiotics when there's no bacteria to fight? What? Why does that make a difference?
Sure. Well, I think there are two reasons. One problem for you is that antibiotics, like any drug, have side effects. Allergic reactions are perhaps the most common, but we're seeing a dramatic rise in what's called Clostridium difficile colitis from antibiotics, and lots of other complications associated with them. So one big problem with taking a drug
that you don't need,
or even if you need it, is that there are complications. So if you didn't need the drug and you're taking it and you get a complication, my gosh. The other problem is that when you take an antibiotic, the bacteria that live in and on our bodies that can survive the antibiotic will become resistant. They can survive it because they're resistant to it. So it selects resistant organisms. And over time, what this does is these organisms get into the water, the food supply, et cetera, and we consume those, and so we get these resistant bugs in our body. And this is what people talk about with these, quote, superbugs, that is resistant to all of our antibiotics.
What about using antibiotics on our livestock?
Well, that's just a horrific problem. About 70% of all the antibiotics used in the United States are used in livestock. And almost, not all, but almost all of this is used to promote growth, not to treat disease. And this is an enormous problem with breeding resistant organisms, because the organisms become resistant in the livestock. Those organisms get it into the soil, into the water supply, consumed by human beings. We get the resistant organisms. Other animals get the resistant organisms. And the cycle continues.
Are scientists working on a solution or alternative plans for a potential post-antibiotic day and age?
No, there's enormous work on this. Nothing immediate on the horizon that is going to solve in a large way this problem. But there is a tremendous amount of work on this, because this is, as I mentioned, the great fear that we have.
So as an individual, what can we do to help?
Well, that's what prompted my article was an interesting article that was recently published that looked at close to 100 million Americans who went to either a primary care clinic or an emergency room because of a sore throat. About 10% of those folks had a strep throat, and that can be treated and should be treated with antibiotics. But 90% of those people who went had a sore throat because of viral infections and didn't need antibiotics. Yet 60% of the people who went to those clinics or the emergency rooms with a sore throat got treated with antibiotics.
Well, if a doctor prescribes me something, I'm going to assume the doctor knows what he or she is doing. Is the problem with the patients or with the prescribers?
I think the problem is both with the patients and with the doctors and / the medical system. Mm-hmm. Patients want something to get well, understandably. We all do. And it's hard to hear that this is a viral infection and antibiotics aren't going to help you. You're just going to have to get well on your own, which you will. You want to take the magic pill that's going to get you well in 24 hours and back up and working again or playing again. So patients often demand it, which they shouldn't do. On the other hand, it would take me maybe 30 seconds to write a prescription for an antibiotic, but it might take 5 minutes for me to adequately explain to a patient why they didn't need the antibiotic.
Okay.
And time is such a premium that it's often expeditious just to write the prescription, and doctors shouldn't do that.
All right. Well, Dr. John Swartzberg, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. We always appreciate your visits.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Dr. John Swartzberg, he is the chair of the editorial board for the University of California School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Coming up, we're going to continue our series on the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. So stay with us. If you have any questions, we'll try to answer them. 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. In order for the Affordable Care Act to be helpful to older people, younger people who ordinarily would put off health insurance must be counted. But too few so far have signed up. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. to talk about the economics and demographics of the Affordable Care Act is Olga Kazan. She's an associate editor at The Atlantic, where she writes about health. Welcome back to the show, Olga.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Why are young people such a sought-after demographic for enrollment?
Well, it basically has to do with this idea that they will help balance out some of the older people who sign up because they're healthy, and health insurers tend to make money off of healthy people and they lose money off sick people. And since we don't actually know the exact health condition of everyone who signs up because they can't health insurers can't choose their customers based on those factors anymore, mm-hmm. the best proxy that we have for how healthy someone is now is how old they are. So that's why the administration and some of these insurers are really trying to get more young people to sign up because they think that they'll be healthy and that they will therefore profit off of them.
What do we know so far about the sign up? Do we have any kind of breakdown between ages yet?
Absolutely. So the most recent numbers are that about 24% of those who have signed up are between 18 and 34, but it really kind of varies by state. That's lower than the administration hoped for, but it's on par with their proportion of the U.S. Population. Most of the people who have signed up for the exchanges so far are in the 55 to 65 age range. About 33% of them are. So it is skewing a little bit older. It's only about 65% of the administration's goal for this time is how many young people have signed up.
How much does the counting take into account that the Affordable Care Act lets parents keep their children on their coverage until they're 26?
So this is for people signing up for the kind of individual market. So it's people who aren't insured through any other kind of system. So not through their employer or their parents. This is just looking at who are all the people out there who could sign up for, you know, the individual market, and have they signed up? And so a lot of people, it looks like, haven't yet.
What's being done to encourage young people to sign up? I know California is launching a pretty hefty campaign. We've heard about the controversial campaign in Colorado. Can you tell us about some of what's going on out there?
Sure. There are the sort of infamous brosurance ads with the idea of bros or the kind of fratty college guys doing keg stands and kind of making health insurance seem cool. A lot of some people thought those were, you know, kind of condescending or too silly for, you know, but the administration is really trying to sell health insurance as something that's kind of sexy and fun in order to try to attract this demographic. And it looks like they are going to buy airtime during the Olympics as well. And then sort of going against that are some of the political ads, like Americans for Prosperity, which is financed by the Koch brothers, has spent a lot of money on television ads that sort of call out individual congresspeople for their support of the Obamacare law. So you kind of have a lot of people putting money into ads right now to either encourage or discourage people for signing up.
When we talk about those Colorado ads, the ones with the kegs and so forth, and there's another one targeted at young women regarding birth control, is it the administration doing that or is it Colorado? I hardly am seeing anything in Ohio one way or the other.
Right. So it's sort of weird because it's this. So a lot of these are run by like the state exchanges. So they're sort of based in the state and it's set up by the state. But they get their money through the federal government. So it sort of just depends on what you consider running something. Like Covered California is doing this gigantic campaign right now with celebrities and funny videos. And so they operate out of California, but then they get their money from the government and they hope to kind of spread their messages and their videos throughout the country.
What do we know about the ads that are going to run during the Olympics? Those are at the top, coming from the top at the administration level.
Right. I don't know too much about those yet. I'm not sure if we've seen exactly what those are going to look like.
Are young, healthy people just being slow in signing up? Isn't it logical that the sickest might be the first ones to sign up?
Right. So people are kind of, they do tend to postpone their healthcare decisions. That's something that we saw with the rollout of Medicare Part D. So it's not super surprising. We have 2.2 million people who have signed up by the end of December, and they wanted 7 million people to enroll. But, you know, a lot of people who analyze this stuff think that, you know, a lot of people are going to start signing up as the deadline nears because you are going to have to pay a penalty at a certain point if you don't have health insurance. So it's kind of not quite time to panic yet, but the news is also not especially good.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any efforts anywhere that you know of to appeal to parents to get their kids signed up? Because I'd drop kick my kid out of, you know, from here to, you know, across a football field if he, you know, was eligible and did not take advantage of this.
Right. So a lot of these ads are appealing toward moms. For example, the Covered California, I think one of them is, some of them are geared toward young people, and then some of them are geared toward moms, because I guess moms share a lot more on Facebook. So they, I think, have people singing like Golden Oldies. I haven't seen all of the mom-based ads, but you know, they're designed to appeal to sort of an older demographic or someone who's more likely to be concerned about their kids, as opposed to some of the other videos that are more just like slapsticky and crazy.
The Spanish language version of healthcare.gov is having a lot of troubles. Cuidado de salud.gov, I guess, is what it's called. Is that adding to the slow youth sign up? Can you tell us more about the Spanish site's troubles and how they'll get it fixed?
Right. So apparently that is kind of really confounding. It looks like it was written either in like Spanglish or kind of automatically translated by some sort of program.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the White House's justification for this is that Latino people read some English, so they should be able to kind of muddle their way through. Of course, a lot of the kind of Latino health advocacy groups are kind of calling bunk on that and saying that, you know, this is par for the course as far as government websites and government documents not being translated adequately into Spanish. And it truly is a problem, because in a lot of states that have high Hispanic populations are also the states where, you know, the individual states themselves haven't done a great job of promoting Obamacare, of talking about it, trying to get people to sign up, being activists for it. So if people are kind of relying on healthcare.gov, the Spanish version, to help them through the process, they might be kind of stumped.
Of course, you're not talking about California when you're talking about the states that aren't doing a very good job of promoting it. It's Arizona, Texas,
right,
New Mexico.
Exactly. Yeah. Unfortunately, it is a kind of exact clear dividing line as far as the party of the leadership that's in charge of the state. You're right. So it's not California.
What happens if there just aren't enough healthy people paying into the system? Now, you said they're shooting for 7 million total. So what happens? What's the tipping point? Do we know anything about that?
Right. So here's the thing. So I'm in my late 20s, and I went on the site, and I tried to I get health insurance through my employer, but I tried to look at plans as though I was trying to buy it through the exchanges. And I don't qualify for subsidies, and I live in Virginia.
Hmm.
So for me, it was $230 to $245 for a silver plan. That would be my monthly premium. For someone who's 30 years older than me, it was more like $550 to $570. So it's clear that insurers really do think that the older people are going to be spending more money, and also that they're going to be profiting a lot more off of them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still not really clear exactly how healthy each one and each person in each of those demographics is going to be. So, you know, we don't know if rates will go up, because we don't know how, say, healthy or unhealthy those young people are if they do sign up, or how healthy or unhealthy the older people will be. And, you know, right now the projections from a lot of health policy researchers are that even if the rates of the young people signing up stay the same, the premiums would only be about 2.5% higher than they would be if the age distribution was more like what the administration wanted. So if more young people were signing up, it wouldn't make that much of a difference as far as premiums. And also, the law provides for some kind of benefits and some kind of offsets for the insurers for the first couple years. It gives them a little bit of extra money to make it through while they still have this, you know, if they happen to have a group of people who are really unhealthy or really old, they'll get some offsets from the federal government to help them through so that premiums don't just skyrocket. So a lot of analysts are kind of thinking that the idea that, you know, this will all get too expensive and we'll enter some kind of death spiral, that idea is a little overblown, that we just need to kind of wait and see, you know, who signs up by the deadline and what their health status actually is.
Joyce in Canton, you're on the air with Atlantic reporter Olga Kazan. Welcome to the show, Joyce.
Thank you. My question was, I was wondering that the young people who are unemployed, are they still eligible for the Affordable Care Act or what?
Did you say the young people who are unemployed?
Yes.
So, yes, if you were unemployed and you are not on your parents' insurance, yes, you are qualified for the Affordable Care Act. You can sign up through healthcare.gov, and you will likely get some stipends or some help with your premiums and your deductibles because you probably don't make very much if you're unemployed.
And you may qualify for Medicaid, and in Ohio, at least, they did expand the Medicaid.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. So in Ohio, you may qualify even for Medicaid if you don't have a job.
But you'll go to healthcare.gov and they'll get you where you need to go. Regardless.
Exactly. Yes.
Right. Thanks a lot, Joyce, for that question. It just tells us that there still are a lot of basic questions out there, Olga. So far, there are a lot of people who've signed up but are still having trouble accessing services because their information wasn't transferred to insurers properly. Has that been much of the case, or is that getting better?
Right. So I think it, especially at the beginning of the year, because a lot of people signed up to get coverage starting January 1st, a lot of people were finding that even though they signed up and they paid their and they got their insurance cards, when they went to, say, the pharmacy or to their doctor, they couldn't use their benefits for whatever reason. And a lot of the thinking has been that there was some sort of problem in healthcare.gov. You know, as you know, it's been really error-prone. Mm-hmm. Getting all of that information over to the insurers, having the insurers kind of get all that information ready. You know, it's like it's a big bureaucratic process usually, and here you have a lot of people doing it all at once. So at the beginning of January, there were definitely some people, I'm sorry, not clear on the numbers, who were having this kind of problem where they thought they were signed up, but then they were having trouble accessing benefits. But, you know, a lot of analysts think that it's going to get better as we go just because it'll be more of a slow trickle as opposed to kind of this crush of people.
You know, we're just hearing a lot about this Target, the problem with the people who are shopping at Target and the security problem with their bank records. People are getting really sensitive about this now. I know you've written about electronic records transfers and safety concerns. What are you finding?
Well, as far as there haven't been as many kind of data concerns with healthcare.gov specifically. Mm-hmm. What I'm more working on is looking at why so many doctors are still not signing up for electronic health records. So if you go for if you go to the doctor, a lot of times, you know, they'll still have the paper charts that you see, like the manila envelopes with all of the little stickers stuck in them. So I'm just, and actually there's a law that kind of is urging them to try to digitize those records and is going to start penalizing them if they don't. So I'm looking at why kind of so many doctors are still resisting. Huh. And one reason for that is actually that they are worried that there's going to be a lot of, you know, data leaks or that they somehow will get their information hacked and then be subject to lawsuits. So that's kind of scaring a lot of doctors. So similar to that, the Target issue that you mentioned in that it's a data protection issue for some of them.
All right, Olga Kazan, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Olga Kazan, she's an associate editor at The Atlantic where she writes about health. Thanks for joining us today on Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.